eLearning Brunch, your podcast for digitalization and learning. Hi, and welcome to another episode of eLearning Brunch. Today we have a really exciting topic, interesting topic. And the topic is digitalization and learning disabilities. So also in this podcast, it's going to be a first because I have not one, but two guests with me, and it's a very international podcast. I have with me today Shay Whistle and Malte Ahrens, and let's start with the introduction of Shay. Shay, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for being available for our podcast, and give us a little bit of background on you, on what you do, and how you got to your role today. I won't take anything away from our listeners. It'll be a little bit of a Sherlock Holmes thing. They'll have to listen to the podcast to see what you say to get information. So go ahead.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm so excited to be talking with you my evening. I think it's your morning.
Yes, it is. It's 10 o'clock in 10 Germany. O'clock. Yes.
Nice, decent hour. I'm Shay, and I am the CEO and founder of the Dear Dyslexic Foundation, and we are a national organisation in Australia, but we're situated in Melbourne, and we're just going into our sixth lockdown at the moment with COVID, so online learning and everything on the computer is huge topic at the moment and a really important topic to be talking about. We support young people and adults who have dyslexia and other learning disabilities. And I started the foundation in 2015 because I was diagnosed with dyslexia and dysgraphia when I was 27. And what I found through my journey of self-discovery was that there was really a lack of support for young people and adults, particularly in the workplace. And so I really wanted to change that because a lot of the focus was on children, which is extremely important. But our learning disabilities don't go away as you move into adulthood. Sometimes they can become worse, or we can have poor mental health and well-being. And so I felt it was really important that we started a conversation around the challenges and the strengths that we have when we have dyslexia.
Okay, sounds fantastic. And that's we had a previous podcast which kind of initialized this whole thing, and where we talked about the digitalization of child and adult education. So this is kind of like an add-on to that, where we now look at what digitalization does for people with learning disabilities. So let me introduce the second person in our podcast, which is Malte Ahrens of the IMC, and he is our senior expert on blended learning. So Malte, if you could introduce yourself.
Yes, of course. Hi, Kenny. Hey, Shay. Thanks for having me in this conversation. Well, I guess I have quite a long history of learning in my career during and after university. I have a master's degree in German literature, linguistics, and English. I was working for 5 years as trainer for German as a foreign language, preparing foreign students for studying in Germany, and at the same time working as research assistant for the TestDaF Institute, creating and evaluating language entrance tests for the admission of foreign students to German universities. That was basically my first contact with teaching and learning. And since 2007, I'm working as instructional designer, team lead for instructional design teams, and right now as specialist for blended learning solutions for e-learning and general training solutions. During my career, and especially in my job right now, I get in contact with quite a few challenges concerning learners and learning in general. That's why I find this topic quite interesting. I'm happy to be in this conversation.
Yeah, so thank you very much. So the purpose of this conversation is to, I think, raise awareness, both in terms of educating our listeners on people with disabilities, with learning disabilities, and that's Shay's expertise. And then we're going to talk with Malte then about how digitalization can affect that, and hopefully we can integrate those two. So let's kick it off with a little bit more of in-depth knowledge on the topic, and that would be then for those listeners that are unfamiliar with learning disorders, specifically dyslexia. Shay, can you give us a little bit more insight on what exactly dyslexia is, and how it is diagnosed, and how it is treated, or how people with that disorder, how do you cope with that?
Sure, I could talk all night on this topic. So I'll try and be as short as possible, but I trained as a speech pathologist first, so it was interesting hearing about linguistics because I had to learn some of that, but I don't want to digress. So dyslexia is predominantly a reading disorder, disability. There's a lot of different terms used that people might hear of. And people can have difficulties reading with their reading fluency, understanding what they've read, and the speed of how they read as well. And it's really difficulties putting those sounds together to make a whole word, and then to be able to read those words in a sentence, and pulling those words apart into the different sound segments. And so at the core base is that reading challenge. But what we've found is that on top of that, people can then start to have difficulties with executive functioning, so challenges with organising themselves, time management. It starts to broaden out to maths challenges for some people as well, navigation, so getting left and rights confused. So, and then all these other challenges start to occur. And what we've found is that people that have dyslexia may have what we call co-occurring difficulties. So in my case, I've got dysgraphia, which is a reading writing difficulties, so putting my thoughts on paper. Some people might have dyscalculia, which is difficulties with maths, or dyspraxia with difficulties with coordination, or you might have autism and dyslexia, or ADHD and dyslexia. So you can have a mix of things as well. Usually people will have more than just one difficulty. And some of the other areas that you might notice someone with dyslexia has challenges with spelling and grammar. As well, it's normally a key one. So when someone structures an email, it might be a little bit confusing to read, and you might think someone's not paying attention or they're rushing their work in the workplace. That's a common assumption. Or people are being lazy or just not putting in the effort, or it's taking them so much more time than other people to do tasks that everyone else is doing. So there's some of the characteristics of dyslexia and what you might see playing out in the workplace.
That's extremely interesting. I never, I haven't really delved into the topic, so I wasn't aware that it was so deep. In other words, what I find interesting is that you have a, co-occurring. Yeah, exactly. So I wasn't aware that basically you had dyslexia as such, and then you had other elements that that come into play. So you said navigation, and also I think it was a math disability, so to say. So that's really, really interesting. I didn't know that I think most commonly, you know, most people have a common idea of what dyslexia is. Oftentimes it's also used, you know, of course, in a derogatory method, which I guess a lot of people have to face. So that's, I guess, one of the challenges. So how is it diagnosed? That would be the next thing that I'd like to know.
So if you're lucky, I don't know what it's like in Germany, but in Australia, if you're lucky, you'll get picked up in primary school and you'll be diagnosed by an educational psychologist. And sometimes a speech pathologist as well will help with that diagnosis. As you progress into adulthood, normally a neuropsychologist would assess. And again, sometimes a speech pathologist may assess or may support that assessment. So that's in Australia, but around the world it's very different. Even the term dyslexia, some people won't use. So in a lot of countries, they'll use the term specific learning difficulties or specific learning disorder. Or in Australia, we use the term learning disability, and dyslexia sits under that broader term of a learning disability. So you'll have dyslexia, dysgraphia. So depending on what country, usually though it would be some type of psychologist, and then you might have other allied health or education people supporting that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did a little bit of research and I found that roughly somewhere around 20% of the population either have been diagnosed or identified, or I'm not sure what the correct term would be, with dyslexia, because according to what I read, it was one of the most common forms of neurocognitive disorder. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh.
Yeah. Lucky. Okay. As you can notice, this is not my topic expertise, so it's a tough topic. So you said that we talked about how it's diagnosed. Is it found out early enough? Because the next question of course would be how it's treated, and I think that's where you can make a significant difference, is how soon you diagnose the situation. For you, for example, you stated that you were diagnosed with it at 27. So that means for a large part of your young adulthood life, you were confronted with challenges that you didn't even know you had, and you didn't know how to cope with. So how then is it treated, and what can we do to identify it at an early stage?
So this is a complex question. And again, depending on what country you live in, but you're right, the sooner we get to diagnose children, the better their outcomes in life are. And normally treatment, we'd use the term intervention. So if a child can access speech therapy, they can access a tutor, then they've got a better chance of improving their reading skills and all those other things that I mentioned as well. So, and then you can get into debates around, well, should everyone be taught phonics in schools or whole language? And so there's all these other debates around what's the best way for the starting blocks of education for children, and then how we might be able to pick up those children that are struggling early so then they can access intervention. We found that it's very expensive, so a lot of children miss out if the school can't provide intervention, and it's on the onus of the parents to get a diagnosis and then treatment, then children can fall through the gaps because it's quite expensive in Australia. I'm not sure what it's like in Germany. And what we found is it's generally genetic. So we suspect my dad's dyslexic, one of my brothers is, one of my nephews. So it often runs in families. So it could be that the child is identified and then the parent realises that actually I'm doing the same things. And it's on a spectrum. So for some children and adults, it can be mild, and for other people, it can be really extreme. And I think it comes back to, have they had an assessment early? Did they access intervention early? What's their path being into adulthood?
Okay. So overall, you have basically two points. The first one is that as I already mentioned in the question, actually, so the earlier you can diagnose it, the better. That's the one fundamental thing. Now, the second part is that you said, where it diverges is whose responsibility is it to identify that? Is it the responsibility of the educators identify students with disabilities, or is it a responsibility of the parents, and then who treats it? So that's a huge discussion, I think, which I don't think at this point our podcast will really cover. I'm sure that you can you have a website that our learners, our listeners can go to, and there they can get more information on that topic. So we now have a bit, I mean, we just dipped our little bit, our big toe into the discussion of what dyslexia is, and everything that's involved with it. Like you said at the beginning of the podcast, you could talk for hours on it. we only have 45 minutes, so let's focus on young professionals and adults. On your website, I saw on DearDyslexic.com that you support these people with the general question of should I or should I not tell people that I have dyslexia? They had 5 points, I believe, that you have listed, which is tell people after you know them, speak to your human resource department, know your strengths, know your limits, get the tech, and teach your employer. Could you explain those topics a little bit more in detail for us?
Sure. Disclosure is a really personal decision in the workplace. In Australia at the moment, there's not a lot of support when people do disclose. So we really try to help people when they're wanting to do that. And it might be that they're really struggling in the workplace and they're at a point where if they don't tell their employer they've got dyslexia, you know, they could be performance managed or they could lose their job. So it's a really stressful time for them. And so what we've found is that a lot of people go into the workplace, they get their job, and they might spend a bit of time demonstrating that they have the skills to do the job and then disclose that they've got dyslexia. So that's if people come to us and say, oh, we want to tell, like, should I say it in an interview? And we won't tell anyone, no, you shouldn't, or yes, you should. But we like to look at the pros and cons of what may happen if you do or if you don't. Mm-hmm. So that's why.
Quick question there on that point. We've gotten to the point in our society where we are more inclusive and more considerate. So, and that movement has taken more and more center stage. So we now have laws and regulations to include people that are handicapped. So where does that fall? I mean, where do you see that for people with learning disorders? I mean, shouldn't that be also, is that the goal that we're heading to? Is that should also be commonplace, that is something that you can openly address, just like when you're sitting in a wheelchair?
Definitely, yes. In an ideal world. And look, the world is changing, as you said. You know, we are protected under the Discrimination Act and the Human Rights Act in Australia now, like many countries, if you're diagnosed with a disability. And I think, you know, the narrative around neurodiversity and inclusion and diversity in the workplace, these shifts are occurring. But what we're finding at the moment is that people with learning disabilities aren't really at the table yet, because they're talking about inclusion and diversity of LGBTQI culture, you know, autism starting to be, people with autism are starting to be at the table in Australia. Mental health is another one. So as we progress in society around improving equity and access for people, all people of every nation, creed, religion, that people with dyslexia are at that table too, but we're not there yet in Australia. We're starting to see the shift, but it's not often that you'll hear someone openly say, I'm dyslexic, in the workplace yet. Mm-hmm.
So we still have a way to go before we can make that into a simple topic to talk about, just like the weather.
Yeah, and I mean, the UK has done a great job. If you look at some of the work out of the UK, and even on LinkedIn, you'll notice now people putting, I'm dyslexic, or, you know, I have autism, or different neurodiversities or divergences on their profile. So it's changing, the culture is changing, but I still see, particularly in Australia, there's a long way to go.
Okay, so we've established that basically the choice is left up to the individual, and that you basically encourage that they establish themselves or get to know their workplace before they make that contact. You have also here, know your strengths and know your limits. What does that refer to?
So everybody has areas in the workplace that they're really good at. So for me, you know, my background is health and project management, and I'm really good at project management. But if you sit there and ask me to write a briefing paper to the department or to do an end of quarter report, that's my limitation. Now, I can do it and I can draft it, but it's not at the standard of a manager. And so that's where we try to work with people to say, what are your strengths in the workplace? Because everyone has them. And everyone has limits as well. Everyone needs areas that they need support in. No one is a perfect package. And so it's encouraging people to see what they're good at, so then that helps build their self-confidence as well within the workplace. And then, you know, if you know that you're not going to be able to write that report or you're not going to be able to get it to that standard, what strategies have you got in place? So for me, it's always been a colleague helping to edit my work, or I've had text-to-speech on my computer so I can hear the mistakes, I can't see them. So it's giving myself enough time to get it to a certain standard. And knowing your limits, then what are the strategies you can put in place to support them?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's two pieces of advice that I get. I think that actually goes for people that, you know, without disabilities, know your strength, know your limits. That's good advice straight across the board. And incidentally, also mentioned that you do project management. I didn't see that in your vita. Seems that there's so much stuff that you do that I haven't even gotten a complete list of things that you do. Okay. So know your strength, know your limits. And then we have the last two topics, which are get the tech and teach your employer. Let's take a look at those. Could you delve into those a little bit more?
So, I mean, as I said, everyone's on a spectrum, and everyone, the way dyslexia impacts people is individual. So I'm not the best tech savvy person when it comes to, for myself personally, because I've relied on human beings my whole life. My mum got me through school and university. My auntie now edits my work for my research for my doctorate. So I've always had a human being supporting me. But as the generations are coming up and the tech's becoming more and more workable, people should be looking at what tech can they use. Like, I can't live without spell check. I mean, no one can, whether you've got dyslexia or not. We all need some type of assistance. And even, you know, like Google Maps, I get so lost. So I, you know, there's simple things like that that everybody uses. But then when we're in the workplace, it's what are some other things that can help you? So there is text-to-speech, and, you know, something like that's now on Microsoft. So people don't even need to know. You can just be running work documents through Microsoft, and, you know, it looks like you're just sitting on the computer like everybody else. On our website, as an example, we've got text-to-speech. We've got it so it can highlight different passages for people. Some people like a different coloured background because white is too hard for them to read. So it's getting to know your disability or your difficulties and what tech might be out there. And that can take a lot of trial and error. Like, I've got a reading pen that for me, you know, it reads every single word really slow. And so I don't have the time. I need something that's faster. And as we progress into adulthood and we're in these fast-paced work environments, it's, you know, we need to find the tech that can keep up. And that's what I have found challenging, is sometimes the tech isn't as fast as what's needed in the workplace. But I think getting to know what resources are out there to help you is really important, especially if you don't want to disclose, but even if you do want to disclose and get that support from your employer to implement that tech on your computer.
Okay. So getting the tech and teaching your employer, I think, is the perfect segue to our discussion. Since we say, what potential does digitalization have, digitalization of education hold for people with learning disabilities? So for that, I'd like to then now go over to Malte. And Malte already said that, explained a little bit in his thing that he's an expert on blended learning. So, Malte, could you pick up that topic of blended learning again and maybe give a little bit of insight of where you see blended learning, especially the creation of content, maybe that will probably be the focus of how that can help people with learning disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Before I go to deeper into that topic, I'd like to say that whatever training or learning is done in organizations and institutions, it always is confronted with a certain culture in this organization. And therefore, I really believe that accessibility should be an essential part of the organization's culture in general, whether it comes to learning or training or any other topic of work-related topic. And speaking of culture, accessibility should also be, of course, part of the learning culture. By that, I mean that right now we're talking about dyslexia, but the learning culture should offer a general open approach to other impairments like visual, hearing, mobility impairments, which is fundamentally is essential, I believe, to reach all employees, no matter what where they stand and where they come from. And coming back to the digitalization of training, I think that we right now have the chance to mix learning formats, digital learning formats, and choose a more multisensory approach to learning. For example, by using video learning, but also by using audio with subtitles, on-the-job tasks, performance aids, and that's what I found interesting, Shay. You said you get assistance from colleagues, and we can also do this with learning to build learning tandems and assist people with learning. And therefore, I think digitalization of training and learning formats really offer good chances to broaden our format mix and use more multisensory approaches to learning.
Okay, so as I already in your title, blended learning expert, Malte, you again approach the topic from a wider perspective, which is very interesting. And also, one of the questions I had that I'll pose to both of you, which Malte, you addressed a little bit, was: is the responsibility of the individual or the organization to increase awareness and acceptance or/slash inclusion of people with learning disorders? I think for Malte, you hinted that it was the responsibility of the organization in terms of inclusion. Shay, what would your opinion be?
I'd agree with Malte, and I think it's two-way relationship. I think, you know, the best workplaces to work in are those that are inclusive of everyone, and, you know, accessibility is front and center. And I think that we need to be in a safe work environment where we can disclose our challenges, whatever they may be, and feel that we're psychologically safe to do that. And I think people can only feel safe when their organisation has inclusion and diversity and accessibility at the forefront of what they're doing as part of their workplace culture.
Okay, fantastic. The interesting, I have to kind of, you can't see me now because I'm on a podcast, but I'm kind of smiling because when I talked to Malte about the our topic earlier, that was one of the things that like he already said now, that he focused on was basically the perspective of a whole. So although we're now talking about the specifics of what the digitalization will do for people with learning disorder, it's not, I think what Malte was saying and what you're also saying, it's only part of the whole. So it's a little step, but it has to be viewed with other things in conjunction. So let me bring this back to you, Malte. So if you were to construct specific content for people with disabilities. How would you go about that? One of the things that we've done in our organization, the IMC, I know for sure, is we've created barrier-free access to content. At least that's some of the requirements that we had from government organizations. But could you take us into a little bit more of how you would approach the situation, or how you would what you would do to develop content for people with learning disabilities?
Mm-hmm. I think there are several sides to start the approach. One side would be, e-learning offers good accessibility in general. So that's I think that's a good path to follow. Everyone with an internet access can access e-learning offers. And the reading, listening, and learning pace can be determined by the user. But for example, blind or visually impaired people probably have difficulties in filling out forms or navigating the training. And so there are two ways to approach this this topic. Would be first look at the technological side of how to give out the training to the people. And Shay, you mentioned text-to-speech engines, or the other way around, speech-to-text engines that can read out the content from training or from a website. There, it is very important to use, for example, HTML formats for your learning and so-called semantic code, which enables these engines, text-to-speech engines, for example, to distinguish between headlines, content, probably image explanations. So there's a technical side to it, and also the instructional design side of it. And on this, this side, there are certain certain tips or approaches that that you can follow. Let me just mention a few of them. For example, you should always put longer training units into smaller modules. So a modularization of the training structure can really help to focus on small learning units. Another one is to use sans-serif fonts, because they're much easier to read. For example, they're rounder and they're much clearer and easier to grasp. A third thing could be to use restrained formatting. For example, use only bold font for emphasis. Use certain font size, for example, between 12 and 14 points, and only use left aligned texts and single columns, which make reading and comprehension much easier. And there are other things like visual orientation by using headlines, by using structuring elements to structure your learning content, or the use of colors. For example, what you should really avoid is to use patterns or images as backgrounds for text, or weak contrasts between the type and the background, or for example, a light font on a dark background. And which is interesting, but nonetheless very important, is to avoid, for example, red, green, and pink colors, to cater for those people with red-green vision impairments. And the one thing which is always true, and we know it for years and years, is that a picture is worth a thousand words. Use images and explain and enhance your content with images. Use video, and as I said before, try to apply a multisensory approach to your learning. instead of just using written text or written text and images.
Okay. So there are, gathering from that, there are a lot of things that can be done. Now we get back to the question. As the creation of such content is a cost driven thing. So, or let me back up one question. Shay, since you have the most contact with this type of thing, have you had or viewed any content that was specifically designed for people with learning disorders?
No, I mean, the e-learning course that we've just put out, we've done everything Malton said probably in trying to make it inclusive and accessible. There's nothing specifically designed for people with dyslexia. And I think part of the reason is because everything that we just spoke about is useful for a variety of people. And I think I would just add having as many auditory things that you can listen to or videos really helps people with dyslexia, and that self-paced learning is really helpful for people if you're doing e-learning courses for people that have dyslexia as well. So I think it's those universal design principles that really work for everybody, that is helpful to those that have dyslexia as well.
Okay, that actually throws out, you just made a good point that throws out the second part of my question, and that was actually the creation of content is a cost-driven thing. So the question is, do you see the development as viable for companies pursue content for such employees, so employees with disabilities? And I think in your question and what Malta said, the easier thing is not to generate content specifically for people with learning disorders, rather is to design the content to make it easier accessible, not only for people with learning disabilities, but in general. So using pictures, using images, Malta, you had a whole bunch of points that maybe you could reiterate a couple to get me out of this whole list of explanations. But would that be the general, the better way to do it? Let me ask the question first to Malta and then to Shay. Would the idea be to rather focus on generating a content that is inclusive rather than a content that is exclusively directed towards people with learning disabilities?
Definitely the first one, because by designing accessible content that is accessible for a vast part of our learners, we design better learnings for most people. And I think personally it's a matter of educating instructional designers and learning providers to really focus on accessible content creation instead of catering for a certain group of people and designing the same content, for example, for a different group of people. Therefore, it's a definite yes to use all approaches to instructional design that facilitate accessibility. And I believe these are cost effective because you can apply them during the conceptual phase of the training design, and therefore they are not really cost sensitive.
Okay. Shay, what is your perspective? Would you tend for having content that's developed as a inclusive or content that's more exclusive, so designed specifically for people with learning disorder?
No, I think, again, inclusive, because regardless of a learning disability or disorder, we all learn differently anyway, and I think by having multimodal formats in e-learning and in learning in general, then you're targeting a wider audience, and then it's more cost effective because more people are purchasing the product if it's available to a broad range of people rather than just a small segment of the population. And I think for us, the only thing that we've seen where there's more of a cost is if you're creating your own videos and you don't have your own video studio, or for our e-learning course, we just launched our case study. It was all auditory, so the people spoke in it. So we had actors come and do the voiceovers. But, I mean, any good e-learning course would do things like that anyway. So I think that, you know, we're trying to be inclusive of everyone, and there's some good e-learning courses out there that do that.
Okay. Okay, so in general...
To interrupt you, but as you said before, beforehand, we should have a more comprehensive look at the topic. Creating multisensory blended learning mixes is one part of the whole package. And as mentioned before, you're giving maximum support and orientation, for example, on the learning platform or in the learning environment, or to offer support from colleagues and superiors, team up in learning tandems, or, for example, give flexible deadlines for the learning. These are also, I think, part of the whole picture that should be considered when we talk about digital learning in organizations.
Okay. And so you advocate definitely a holistic approach.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Could I add, for assessments as well, what we've found is that rather than you drop and drag or your yes, no, getting people to reflect on what they've mm-hmm. learnt as well. So just spending time reflecting and then either verbally or written giving that feedback. So we've been looking at what are different ways to assess people's understanding of the content that they've just learnt. Because people with dyslexia can go into those environments anxious that they've got to do an assessment. So that would be the other thing, is how do we make assessments? How can we learn that someone's understood the content and they've engaged in it and they've increased their knowledge or their skills? How can we assess that in different ways?
That's funny that you mentioned that, because that's a challenge. I think I also worked a little bit in the content area, but that's a challenge that we're always faced with. How do you test people without letting them know that they're being tested, and thereby giving them a better you get a better value out of that because. Malta will probably be able to. He's waiting to jump in. I can just tell because I'm stumbling for an explanation here. But in my opinion, we had that request a couple times, is to make the tests in such a format that the people don't really know that they're being tested. Malta, you're ready to jump in here, so I'll let the expert say it. You can probably describe it better than I did now.
Yes, my suggestion would always be to use the Kirkpatrick levels and probably use the assessment within the learning for the obvious reasons. Can I remember what I've just learned? But the thing is, I guess... to take the assessment away from the learning and into the working, so the working, and therefore we need a trusting relationship with colleagues and superiors, which is enabled by an open and transparent culture. Again, because the assessment can only be successful if I can measure the learning within the job,
I can try to translate it spontaneously.
You have to look at the performance of the people to be able to assess if the learning has worked or hasn't worked.
So yes, yeah.
What I want to say is take the assessment out of the learning itself and put it into the performance surrounding, and there you need a trusting relationship between the learner and the disabled learner and the superiors that enables an open conversation, communication between both?
Well, from my opinion here, I see that at least Shay and you have kind of gotten on the same wavelength. So if there's new content to be created, I think the two of you should get together and I think we can work something out. So overall, I think it was a very interesting conversation. And for me, I would say, I see the digitalization of education specifically will have a positive impact for people with learning disorders if, for one, we have people like Shay that always increase the awareness and also enable those people with disabilities to with learning disabilities to better stand up for their rights. I think that would be the correct way to better handle their situation. Specifically, I'm talking about young adults now. And for people like Malte, who have a vision of how to include such information for learners in the content that we create. Any comments on that, or any last comments in that direction, or do you mostly agree with what I've said?
Agree.
Okay. Okay. Agree. Oh, you left me hanging there. Okay. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. So before we finish up the podcast, we always diverge into a completely different direction, and that is my question on cooking. So, do either of you cook? Starting with Shay. Shay, do you cook?
I used to, but my partner does all the cooking because he hates that I don't follow a recipe.
But it has to be result driven. Is it edible? Is it good? I mean,
it's fantastic. I was going to be a chef when I left school originally, so I'm a fantastic cook. But he gets so frustrated that I ad lib to the recipes that I'm not allowed in the kitchen anymore.
Oh, wow. Okay. So then let me ask if you that's going to make it hard now, because my second question is, if you have a go-to recipe or something that you like, what would it be? Now, if you don't follow any recipes, then it's going to be hard for me to get a recipe from you. So do you have anything for me?
I love to cook pasta, so I do have a good pesto. My nonna used to do a pesto and Napoli sauce, so that's something I could put down as a recipe for you if you'd like.
That would be very, very nice. If you could share that with us, that would be cool. I would post it, and then our listeners can not only get the edification of learning about dyslexia and various disabilities, learning disabilities, but also to get a cool recipe. Okay, so then let me swing over to Malte. Malte, do you cook?
Yes, I love cooking.
You love cooking, okay.
For relaxation and for the eating, of course.
Okay.
But I must say, I'm without recipes as well.
Okay. Well, I still have a little bit of time before this podcast goes on air. So maybe if you find time, you could also pass us a recipe. But what would be your go-to dish? Let's say, what's your favorite dish at least?
I love the typical German stews in autumn and winter, using different kind of cabbages. And since I'm vegetarian, I love the vegan version of it. And my go-to recipe would be put onions, smoked tofu, potatoes, and any sort of cabbage together, cook it for a while, and it's delicious.
Yum. I'm a vegetarian too. That sounds great.
Wow. You guys are just like, all these things are, you guys are just vibing here together. I feel like I'm about to leave this conversation here. No, but I'm a flexitarian. So my wife usually tries to decrease the amount of meats that we eat. So I'm good with that. So I think the perfect, for a vegetarian, this is not the perfect thing, but I was at a street food festival, and I actually went to a place, the guy that was doing barbecue, and he was barbecuing that Wagyu beef that he was that he talked about, and he actually put it, for my purposes now, talking to two vegetarians, in a perfect sense. He said that the eating of meat should be a Mazi, you need to help me out here now. You got to translate ein Genussmittel. It should be something that you do on occasion for a special thing, but it shouldn't be the basis of your nutrition. So that's.
I'm probably a bad translator since I don't promote eating meat.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'm completely out of this conversation. Okay, so in essence, I was trying to save my hide and say I don't eat as much meat as I used to. I think the idea of eating meat on occasion, when it is a special occasion, is okay for me. So I'm getting closer to the vegetarian viewpoint there. Okay.
You would get on with my partner who's becoming a vegetarian. He was a meat lover when I first met him.
Okay. So I would say that's all the time we have for today. So we've gone over the 45 minutes just by a little bit, but I think that most of the listeners will enjoy listening to our podcast, and I think the awareness, once again, of people with learning disabilities has been brought up a notch, I hope. Also, in combination of what the future holds in terms of digitalization and what we can do to include people with learning disabilities in our digital movement, has also been addressed again. So Malte is, I think, already looking forward to his creative ideas on what to do. So thanks again to my interview guests, Shay Whistle and Malte Ahrens. If you like the podcast, please smash the like button. Or if you have any comments, please let me know. And we'll do our best to provide any detailed information that you have or questions that you have. As always, all the information can be found, or infos can be found, under our hashtag eLearningBrunch. The next podcast will be on November 12th, hopefully. And as I always say, be part of the eLearning revolution and empower yourself with knowledge. Listen to eLearning Brunch. Thank you very much. And we will be posting all the links to Shay and links to Malte and the IMC in our on our webpage. So thank you very much. Shay, any last comments?
No, just thank you. It was a real pleasure speaking to you both tonight. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, because for me, it was another learning opportunity. I learned more about individuals with learning disabilities. So thank you very much for opening or widening my horizon on it. And like I said, your website, deardyslexia.com, is that correct?
That's right.
Is accessible for anybody. And I've perused the site a little bit, and it's a very, very well put together site. So props to you there on that. And I think that anybody who has any inclination that they think they might have a learning disability should, I encourage to check out the site and do a little bit of research on that. Malte, any last words from you?
Thanks for having me, Kenny. And thanks for having this topic in the podcast. And Shay, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I love your work. Please keep up.
Thank you so much. You too.
Okay, then thank you very much. Have a nice day. And as always, stay safe in these crazy times.
You too. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.